Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour is the drought and how it affects the food we eat. A recent opinion poll by the Public Policy Institute of California revealed that 39% of Californians rate the drought as the single most important issue facing our state. Not surprisingly, the most concerned citizens are those living in the Central Valley, over half of whom rate the drought as their number one issue. And they have reason to be concerned. According to researchers at UC Davis, about 428,000 acres of irrigated cropland won't be planted this year. Farmers are losing investments and running out of water, enough to make Governor Jerry Brown declare the very fabric of modern California is at stake. For a state that produces roughly half of America's fruits, vegetables, and nuts, it's a major problem. We've already seen the effects of the drought on food prices, and as Californians continue to adjust our lifestyles to drier times, we're starting to think twice about what we eat. Media outlets and food writers tell us that eating water-hogging lentils and almonds is bad form. However, many policy analysts and researchers question the usefulness of avoiding so-called thirsty produce as a way to save water. How exactly is the drought impacting who grows what and where in California? How much water is used to produce the food we see in the grocery store? And why are some crops thirstier than others? Can we and should we attempt to change our diets to suit the drought? Joining me in studio to discuss these issues is Doug Parker. He is director of the California Institute for Water Resources at the University of California Division of Agriculture and Natural Resources. Welcome to the program, Doug.
Thank you, David.
And joining us by phone is Nathaniel Johnson, a food writer at grist.org. Welcome, Nathaniel.
Hey, great to be here.
We invite you, our listeners, to call in to join our conversation. The phone number here is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at klw.org, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. Doug Parker, let's start with you. How much of California's water is used for agriculture?
Sure. California agriculture uses about 42% of the developed water supplies in the state, with the rest of the water going towards environmental purposes in the high 40s, and then urban uses as well, about 10%. So a fair amount going to agriculture.
And how do farmers divide up that 42%? How does one farmer get a certain allocation and another farmer get a different allocation?
California has a very complicated rights system for water. Our system is based on actually two sets of rights. There are riparian rights, so that we have growers who live along a stream and they have a right to pull water out of that stream. And we have appropriative rights as well. And that's sort of a first in time, first in right. So essentially, most of the water in the state is tied up in this rights system, where earlier growers or generations ago, people started farming land and made a claim on that water. And so those are the senior rights holders who get water first. And then we just sort of move down the chain in terms of water rights. So it's a very complicated system, and it's really tied to the land. Those rights transfer when you sell the land, so it belongs to the land itself.
And Nathaniel Johnson from grist.org, where does water come from in this state, and how does it get to the farms?
Well, it comes from the global hydrological system, and so you either have water falling in the mountains as snow or rain and filtering down through the rivers and down through the land into the aquifers. Or you have the aquifers that have been building up in the groundwater for hundreds of thousands of years, which we're now pumping out.
And let's talk about what the biggest crops are, just again, to give an overview to our listeners. Back to you, Doug Parker, for the California Institute for Water Resources. What are the biggest crops in the state, and what parts of the state are they primarily grown in?
Yeah, we grow quite a bit of crops in California. We actually have over 400 different crops grown in the state, probably more than anywhere else on the planet. Our biggest crops are alfalfa, which is being used mostly as an animal feed for dairies and horses occasionally. We also grow a lot of fruits and nuts. Almonds are one of our largest crops. Pistachios are very large. Vines, so vineyards, grapes, we're very big in that as well. They're grown in different parts of the state, so most of the fruits and nuts are grown in the Central Valley. many of it south of Sacramento, down towards Bakersfield. A lot of fruits, a lot of vegetables are grown in the Salinas Valley, which is a different water system than the Central Valley. So we've got different places that we have the different crops as well.
And what? How does a farmer decide what crops they want to grow? Is that partly the climate in this area affects? You know, is going to be best for this type of crop? Is it government policies? You know, what is it that affects the decision to a farmer of what to plant and what not to plant?
It's not government policies so much in California as it might be in other parts of the country, because we don't have a lot of programs that impact our crops. It's really the grower looking at what climate they live in. There's 9 or 10 bioclimes in California, so depending on where you are in the state, you're going to have a different climate, the coastal fog climates versus the inland drier, hotter climates. And don't forget Imperial Valley as well, clear south, much hotter. Also, their soils are very important. So different soils are going to be much more productive with different crops. So you can't grow certain crops on certain soils. So what's your soil? What's your local climate going to be like? And when you look at climate, you're looking at everything from how cool is it at night to how hot is it during the day to how much moisture do you have. All of those factor into the decision. And ultimately, it comes down to really a business decision for the grower. They're looking at all of their inputs. Land is an input, the quality of the land. How much water do they have? What are their water rights? You know, they need to be thinking, how firm are those water rights? So all of that comes into play, but ultimately it really becomes a business decision.
And can I just add, it's also an ecological decision. They're making decisions about how to rotate their crops so they don't get pest buildup. And so that's something that's often missed in this discussion, that there's, you know, it doesn't just come down to a pure, I mean, that's part of the business decision too, but it's not purely that you can just grow the best thing year in, year out. You do also have to have these rotations.
Which is really a long-term business consideration.
Yeah, but it is a consideration when you look at the crops grown and people ask questions about why are you growing wheat because it's a low-value crop. Well, you may be growing it because it's part of that rotation. So the different crops do phase into it that way.
What about, we've talked a lot about different plants. What about meat? What about dairy farming? There are great water needs there as well. How does that fit into the picture, Nathaniel Johnson?
Well, California is a really big dairy state, and I've seen some figures suggesting that's our biggest cash producer. But that has a significant water impact, both from animals. You know, animals need to drink, and the animals also need feed. So the feed needs water to be produced. Now, a lot of that feed comes from the Midwest. I mean, we're growing a lot of alfalfa for the dairies and for our meat production here in California. But a lot of the grains, the soy, and the corn is coming in on trains from Iowa.
So California water is not being used to grow those crops?
Yes, primarily. I mean, we do grow some corn here, but it's a much smaller percentage than in the Midwest.
And Doug Parker, you had mentioned a little bit about the different crops and how thirsty they are. What are the ones that use the most water in the state?
Well, certainly, if you're looking at water use, animal products are usually the highest users of water, beef, pork, chicken, dairy, things like that. Chickpeas and lentils are fairly high water users as well. In terms of fruits and vegetables, they're quite a bit less. Asparagus would be a high water user of water, maybe using about 20 gallons per ounce. Whereas beef is about 100 gallons per ounce. So you need to look at that. But when we're talking about how much water a crop uses, again, to go back to Nathaniel's point with beef, you know, that water may be water that we're actually sort of importing from Kansas in the form of grain. So it's not always California water that we're using in each of those cases.
And overall, has our food production in the state changed because of the drought?
I think we've seen some modest shifts. I mean, the UC Davis report estimating 500,000 acres of cropland fallowed certainly is shifting a little bit. I don't think we're seeing long-term shifts yet from the drought. We're seeing reductions in production of lower valued crops like cotton and some of the grains, maybe some melons and other things. So there's been a bit of a shift there. We haven't seen a huge change in the permanent crops. There's been a little bit of some trees going out of production. Usually it's an older tree that may have, maybe that's got a 25-year production cycle and it's in year 23 or 20 and you push it out a little early because of the drought. But I don't think we've seen any kind of long-term shifts so far.
And is that partly because, you know, as Nathaniel said earlier, there are long-term impacts here, that the drought obviously is a huge crisis right now, but farmers are not just thinking about the current year or next year, but really need to think in the big picture about the long-term survival of their work?
Yeah, I think growers are going to shift what they do in the long run because of the drought. We've gotten to a situation where I think we've kind of gone a little bit far over into the sort of the permanent crops world of trees and vines, and we don't have that flexibility to adapt to drought. So I think growers in the long run are going to start paying attention to that, especially the ones that don't have senior water rights. But again, these decisions are long-term decisions. If you've got a tree, you know, you're not going to take it out at year 10 if it's still going to be productive for another 10 or 15 years. And in addition, planting decisions can be long run. Planting annual crops, you know, you've got a 3 or 4 month lag time that you need to plan ahead in order to plant that crop. But permanent crops actually take quite a while. You may have to order, like if you want to plant a new almond orchard, you may have to have ordered the almond stock 2 or 3 years in advance. So even in the drought time, you may see people planting things, but it's because decisions were made a ways back.
Nathaniel Johnson, you at grist.org, you've done a lot of reporting on this, and kind of I was wondering if you could just give, what are the different political blocks that are looking to influence policy here? What are the major groups that are really pushing for different reforms right now to the way water is handled in the state?
So there's a few different major groups, and I'm gonna overgeneralize because you can't help but when you try and put people in the groups, overgeneralize. But you have the farmers in the Central Valley who want more water for farming. I mean, water translates into revenue and profits for them. And you have the cities in Southern California that want more money, more water delivered down to them, and they'd like to be able to have a smoother system to move water from Northern California through the Delta down to Southern California. And then you have people in Northern California who are primarily concerned about not screwing up the environment any more than it is, and concerned about flooding, and holding on to the water rights that they currently enjoy. So those are the big blocks that sort of put us in this vice.
And how does that get balanced out in Sacramento? How does the governor interact with each of those groups to try to come up with a solution that's best for the state?
Gosh, I wish I knew. I would love to be in those meetings when the governor is figuring this out. I do know that, you know, Jerry Brown, it seems like he's a pragmatist. You know, he'd like to have some movement forward, and I think that he seems to sort of be wheeling and dealing and seeing where he can find some compromise among these groups to actually get some movement forward. I mean, he's been trying to get some progress on the Delta plan since the first time he was governor, and it hasn't gone anywhere since then. So I think he's pretty interested in just seeing something happen. But maybe Doug has a better perspective on that than me.
Doug, anything to add?
No, I think you've kind of hit on the main points of the groups. I mean, it's a big balancing act. You've got all this history behind it. Like I mentioned, the water rights before come into play. The courts get involved. So you're trying to act in a way to create action to create solutions to the problem, while kind of trying to balance all the different sides.
You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing the drought and California's food with my guests, Doug Parker, director of the California Institute for Water Resources, and Nathaniel Johnson, food writer at grist.org. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Have you changed your diet at all because of the drought? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment on our website, klw.org, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. Doug Parker from the California Institute for Water Resources, I'd like to ask about where the food we grow in California goes, because there's been a lot of press recently about the amount that is exported, and some people are saying, well, wait a minute, we have precious little water, why would we be growing crops and then selling them to the rest of the country or abroad? What can you tell us about that?
Well, California is the supplier of over half of the nation's fruits and vegetables, so that obviously, a lot of the crops are being shipped around the country. We also do export quite a few of our crops internationally. But at the same time, we import a lot of crops, too. California imports probably half of its food. So we have to understand is that we're operating in a global market. And food is like another commodity in that market, you know. And we're importing cars and exporting cars and iPads and other kind of things. So I really look at sort of the water or the crop as really part of that international market that we exist in now.
Nathaniel Johnson from grist.org, would you like to weigh in on that?
Well, I think, I mean, it's interesting that there's this feeling that it's somehow wrong to export water, because it's interesting to examine where that kicks in. You know, is it wrong to export water from the Central Valley to San Francisco? Most people are okay with getting water from the drought-ridden Central Valley. Is it wrong to go next door to Nevada? Probably not. Is it wrong to go, you know, send food all the way to Boston like we've been doing since the dawn of agriculture in the 1880s in California by rail? You know, that's, people don't have a problem with that, but people do start to have a real problem when they start thinking about exporting to China, you know. And I would just invite everybody to examine the prejudice that kicks in there. I mean, if it's an honorable thing to feed Americans, it probably should be an honorable thing to feed Asians as well. And in the end, we're just part of this world economy. And what we really need, instead of asking the consumer to kind of outwit the global supply chain with every purchase, what we really need is to communicate sound environmental choices through policies that ensure that the price of water is communicated in the price of the final products.
Well, and I absolutely want to get to some of those policy solutions or potential policy solutions, but you also just hit on a different point, which is that also in the press, there's been a lot of talk about the thirsty foods, almonds. You know, actually on the ride over here, there was something from the almond growers talking about, oh yes, almonds are great, which is seems very defensive with all the bad press they're getting recently. Nathaniel Johnson, you have written that consumers boycotting certain products doesn't make sense and, in fact, is probably counterproductive. Can you walk us through that argument?
Well, the argument goes something like this. You know, if you're choosing not to buy almonds or avocados from California, what you're doing is you're not supporting the farmer, but it doesn't mean that you're putting water back in the aquifer in California. It just means that you're making it tougher for that farmer to make a profit in this year. And don't forget that farmer and that land still has the water right. If they're not going to use it for almonds, they're going to use it for something else. And so really what boycotting California crops does is discourage farming in California, and it's a really good way if you'd like to see less agriculture and more tract home developments and golf courses and strip malls in California. That's boycotting California crops is a good plan.
Doug Parker, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I tend to follow along in similar lines. I really think that, you know, I mean, growers, they've already planted trees. I mean, we can change our diet in the long run and have some impact. I really don't think we can have a huge drought impact because growers aren't going to go and immediately change. And then, as Nathaniel mentioned, we operate in this global economy. So, you know, we may just end up exporting more water to other places if we choose to do that. I do think that there is room, though, to look at sort of not just the water, but the whole environmental footprint of the foods we eat and think about that as we make our choices.
Absolutely.
Tell us more about that.
Well, so, I mean, if you take the water argument to its extreme, okay, and you want to save California water by not eating California food, then what you're really going to do is you're going to say, okay, take that to its very far extreme. I'm only going to eat imported foods, okay? And then I don't have any kind of California water footprint. I shoved all my water footprint off onto other countries, other parts of this country, and we could have a whole discussion on whether that's the right thing to do. But by only eating imported foods, obviously I'm causing more transportation, probably more greenhouse gases.
Right.
I'm creating problems in other places. So you really got to look at, you know, the balance of all of these things together. It's not just one thing or another, because you end up having trade-offs.
Nathaniel, would you like to add to that?
Well, I do think, I mean, the one thing that I, at least in the past, felt like is sort of a sure thing is that Americans could probably cut back a little bit on their meat production, just or their meat consumption, just because we see anytime you're converting plant matter to meat matter, there's a conversion ratio there. You're losing a little bit of that, and it would be a little more efficient to just eat vegetables. You know, it's very complex. I think you do need animal agriculture as part of sustainable agriculture, but I tend to think that we probably don't need it to the extent that Americans are consuming meat.
Let's take a short break and welcome our listeners into the conversation. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing the drought and California's food with my guest, Doug Parker, director of the California Institute for Water Resources, and Nathaniel Johnson, a food writer at grist.org. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Do you think that consumers should be changing their diets due to the drought? What policies do you think the California state government should be changing in reaction? The number to join to call our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. And let me go now to an email from Judy in San Francisco. And Judy asks, how has the drought impacted the way farmers market their food? Have almond farmers changed their marketing strategy at all?
I have no idea.
That's Nathaniel Johnson from grist.org. What about you, Doug Parker? I know you're not studying the marketing side of this, but...
Yeah, I don't think that we've seen a difference. Certainly not for almonds, I don't think. I mean, almonds are one of our largest export markets of California crops. I think that they're probably just sticking with their current marketing program. It would be interesting to kind of take a look at whether or not, you know, what the impact is of this on the sort of the farmer's market level versus sort of the chain store level. And I don't really have any data on that. I mean, I can see that there may be changes at both levels. Farmers markets, growers are often closer to urban centers, so they may have more expensive water supplies in some cases than growers that are further away. So there may be a little bit of change going on there, but I haven't seen much of it.
I do know that, you know, this could be considered part of marketing, just in that the almond growers have responded to the fact that they've been the butt of the joke here, or the whipping boy, and they've done a lot to try and educate people about what almond farmers are doing to reduce their water consumption, and, you know, how almond farms have shifted to drip irrigation being really the norm, or micro sprinklers. So that has definitely happened.
And my understanding is, even preceding the drought, almond use worldwide was blowing up. Is there any explanation for that?
People are crazy about almonds. So they're I'm biased. I love eating almonds, and I think that I don't know exactly why. You know, maybe it's the success of the almond industry in getting the word out, but it does seem like something that's time has kind of come.
The almond industry has been very proactive on the marketing front and very proactive in terms of creating these international markets for their product. And to go to Nathaniel's point, you know, when we start looking at water use per unit of, you know, of good, you know, you have to look at sort of I like to call it kind of the denominator effect. What are we looking at? Water use per ounce of food, or are we looking at water use per gram of protein, mm-hmm. or per you know, kilogram or grams of vitamin C? So, you know, we fashion our diet. At least we should fashion our diet, you know, with the idea that we're creating, you know, this nutritional food for ourselves, and we need a variety of nutrition to do it. So almonds, you know, when you do the math, almonds come out way ahead if you want to look at water use per, you know, gram of protein. Not so good on other factors. So every crop's going to have these pluses and minuses. So it gets quite complex when we want to look at that full diet.
And kind of the infographics you see on this are anything but complex or nuanced, right? They don't, you know, they probably don't even tell you what the denominator is. There's just a very simplistic way of looking at it to back a story.
Yeah. I mean, you see all these different infographics that compare. It's just, it really is apples and oranges when you get down to it. You know,
literally,
how do you compare across those things?
Nathaniel Johnson?
It's literally apples and oranges in some cases.
Okay, let's go to some of our other listeners here. We have Mary from Brisbane on the line. Mary, welcome to City Visions.
Thanks. You know, I was wondering if organic farming just inherently uses water more wisely compared to conventional farming, and or perhaps it depends on the crop.
Okay, good question, Mary. Thanks for calling in. Yes, Doug Parker, take the first shot at this from the California Institute of Water Resources.
Sure. I mean, organic farming could be a more efficient use of water. It just sort of is going to depend on the farm. Certainly, you know, crop by crop is going to matter. I think one of the things that's more important, whether it's organic or non-organic, is sort of the health of the soil, the soil organic matter. So a lot of people think that organic farms tend to have higher soil organic matter. I'm not sure that that's ever been shown completely, you know, across the board. But if you do have higher, you know, more mulch and more compost in your soils, it helps with water holding capacity. So from that standpoint, I could see that organic farming, to the extent they do that more than other farmers, might be a little more efficient.
Yeah, I'd be willing to go out on a limb and guess that most organic farms tend to have a little bit more soil organic matter, and that helps just hold water in the soil. On the other hand, there's a lot of no-till can also help. If you're plowing up the field, you're going to lose some water in that process, and no-till tends to be non-organic because they're using herbicide to control the weeds rather than using tillage and plowing. There's some great, like, no-till drip system tomato systems that are happening now that also seem to have some benefits in terms of water use.
Okay, Mary, thank you very much for your call. Let's now go to Tim in Berkeley. Tim, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Two quick questions. Last I checked, nobody eats cotton in their diet, daily or otherwise. It's a major user of water in California. Why are we still growing in California? There's a huge surplus nationally and internationally. It's been a source of major litigation between countries through the international treaty tribunals. So that's question number one. And number two, who funds the California Institute for Water Resources? I'd like to know the affiliations and the contributors. I'll just listen.
Okay, Tim, thank you very much for your call. And let's go to Doug Parker from the California Institute for Water Resources. Let's knock out that second question first.
Sure. So the second question being, who funds us? We're actually a unit of the University of California, part of the Division of Ag and Natural Resources, located system-wide at the UC Office of the President. So we're part of the unit that is has cooperative extension. We've got offices in every county in the state with farm advisors who are working with growers on irrigation systems and other things. But ultimately, you know, we're funded by the University of California. We also do actually have funding from the U.S. Geological Survey as well in terms of a grants program. We're part of a national network of 54 water institutes funded by the USGS as well. So we've got those two sources of funding.
Okay, and to the first question on growing cotton.
And to the cotton question, cotton production in California is a fraction of what it used to be. 20 years ago, we grew a lot more cotton than we do now. We still do grow a fair amount of cotton. Most of the cotton grown in California is of a higher quality or a special breed that doesn't grow as well elsewhere. So that's probably the main reason we still see it. But it is a good question, you know, about cotton use and water use.
I think with these questions, the way that we tend to think about it is like as if there was an omnipotent ruler who decided what crops get grown where. And, you know, it might not make a whole lot of sense from that perspective to grow cotton. But the fact is that these are individual farmers making these decisions. And if you go and talk to any one of them, they can explain to you, you know, it makes sense from their perspective. And so the question then from a policy point of view is, okay, if we want to change things, if we want to have more water to go around and have, you know, water in our rivers and healthy fish and a thriving economy, what are the levers that we can exert? And it's usually not picking and choosing what crops get grown. I mean, there would just be no way to do that from a policy perspective.
Well, let's delve into that question now, Nathaniel. What are we've talked a lot about what the governor, what government officials cannot control. What are some things that can be done at the policy level?
Well, I think the most important thing, really the gaping hole in the California water system, is making sure that we regulate groundwater. Right now, this is just a commons. If you can grab it, you can get it. I mean, there are some water districts that are regulating groundwater to a certain extent already, but for the most part, it's if you can sink your straw deeper than the next guy, you can drink his milkshake. And that's just everybody agrees that this doesn't make any sense. And so the legislature passed a law to regulate this. And I think that's the most important thing, making sure that gets implemented. And it's going to the individual water districts. They really wanted to do this in a way that it wasn't just a top-down, you know, Big Brother is going to come in and tell you how it works on the local level. They wanted it to be bottom-up, so it makes sense at the local level. So they're having the water districts write their own plans. So that means it's going to take a while. And there are going to be big fights at those local levels, I'm sure, because, you know, right now we're going from a place where everybody's using more water than there really exists there, and we need to get to a place where you only use as much as comes down in any given year. But if we can solve that problem, I think we'll be in a position to be sustainable.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the groundwater issue is a huge issue. You know, you've got a system here where we've got 150 years of property rights with surface water and zero on groundwater. So we're really starting from scratch there. And as Nathaniel mentioned, I mean, that's going to take some battles. It's going to take some cooperation, too, I hope. You know, I mean, getting communities together to figure out how to do that. And then also, you know, the need to recognize the linkages between groundwater and surface water, you know, because the surface water often is the groundwater recharge. So we really need to get our hands around the entire water system and stop ignoring half of it in that way. The other area in terms of policy that I think that we maybe want to kind of try to keep exploring further, and this is already happening, would be sort of the water marketing idea and allowing or creating better space for people to be able to trade water between different growers or between growers and cities. A lot of that already goes on, but there's definitely room for improvement to make that system work a little bit better.
Yeah, it's a pretty complex red tape enameled system that could be. I mean, in Australia, you can go online and you can buy and sell water the way you can buy and sell stocks, and we're a long way from that.
And Nathaniel, you talked about the new law being passed, and that'll really be up to local water districts to implement it, and that the devil will be in the details of how they implement it. How are they going about it so far within these local jurisdictions with the competing interests? How is that decision-making happening?
Well, it's happening. I've just poked into this a little bit, and it's kind of this long, drawn-out, to be perfectly honest, very boring process of local politics. You know, just lots of local meetings, stakeholders bringing up their issues, educating each other, hammering out what makes sense and what's fair. And so those meetings are happening, but it certainly takes a long time to get everybody on the same page.
And Doug Parker, you mentioned how you have offices throughout the state. Are your colleagues kind of brought in at the local level to help advise these local groups?
Yes, often we are we're certainly participating in the conversations. At each county, we do have cooperative extension advisors who work with the county governments. The county directors are usually very involved with the boards of supervisors in those counties. So the university plays two different roles there. One of the roles we play is as information provider, bringing science, helping to understand the aquifers, helping to understand water use efficiency, all of the science that needs to go behind it. But we're also somewhat of a player in the sort of facilitation game as well in many of these counties, because we are sort of seen as somewhat of a neutral broker. So often it's doing the conflict resolution and facilitation between those groups, because you have to understand is that aquifers don't follow political boundaries. So you may have an aquifer that's shared by three different county governments, seven cities,
right,
14 water districts, and somehow you've got to bring all of those competing parties together and say, how are we going to manage this for the good of all of us?
Let's take a final station break and once again invite you, our listeners, to join us. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing the drought and California's food with my guests, Doug Parker, director of the California Institute for Water Resources, and Nathaniel Johnson, a food writer at grist.org. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at klw.org, or tweet at us at cityvisionsKALW. Let's go now to Heinrich from Alameda. Heinrich, welcome to the program. Heinrich, are you with us?
I'm here. Hello.
Hi. Welcome to City Visions.
Hi. You had a previous caller that asked whether organic farming used more water than conventional farming, but I believe both of your guests misunderstood the question, or in any case, they answered a different question. What I've heard from the head of the Farm Bureau in California, and of course one could argue whether they're a reliable source, he gave the example of strawberries, where conventionally grown strawberries and organically grown strawberries use the same amount of irrigation water per acre, but the yield from the conventional strawberries is approximately 30% higher. So if we look at not how the soil retains the water and so forth, but rather how much water does it take to produce a given unit of food, indeed, by that example of strawberries, organic farming does take more water per unit food.
Doug Parker?
Sure. You have a great point there. And it is, again, difficult to generalize across organic versus non-organic farms. But often case in other farms, I mean, what you're essentially doing is you're substituting other inputs for water, like fertilizer or other inputs. The other thing that we really didn't get to on that question is that often the non-organic farms are larger farms, in general again, and they have more access to capital. So they may actually have more access to the capital necessary for higher-level irrigation systems, things like that. So, I mean, it's difficult to know, you know, I mean, farm by farm is really what you're going to have to go at. But it is a great point that, you know, you really want to be paying attention to. It's not about how much water do I put on an acre of land. It's how much food do I produce per unit of water.
Exactly.
Heinrich, thank you very much for your call. We also have an email from Helen who asks, should we be boycotting Nestle bottled water, or would that just funnel more California water out of the state? Nathaniel?
I'm not a huge fan of these popular boycotts. I mean, the amount of water that Nestle is taking is so minimal in the broad scheme of things, and you know they're paying for it. They're paying us as taxpayers for that water. The thing is, there are political movements are funny things. You know, when Coke was boycotted and attacked for their water use in India, they ended up changing that into something very positive, and they, you know, they have this amazing water conservation plan that they've shifted onto. So sometimes, you know, political movements around these kind of keystone whipping boys, even if they're not making a real change in the actual thing that they're focused on, sometimes they do raise awareness and lead to positive change further on. But again, I try and just stick to the numbers. And, you know, when you look at the amount of water that Nestle is actually taking, it's really not that much in the grand scheme of things.
Okay. We also have Ellen from San Francisco, no longer on the line, but called in to ask. She stated, rice needs a lot of water. Are we still growing as much rice in California as we used to, or are we curtailing that during the drought? What about rice?
Well, again, nobody's in charge of California agriculture. There's no one person who can say we can curtail this. But I do think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Doug, that there has been a reduction in the rice acreage grown. And rice is something that takes a lot of water as it's grown in California, because the way that the rice growers do it is that they use flooding to control weeds rather than using pesticides. By and large. But you
Nathaniel,
also,
you've written, though, that there's some beneficial side effects of that for the environment and for Californians.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you get the first benefit in that you're using less chemicals. You get another benefit in that you're creating habitat for waterfowl, and it's so important that the government has actually done some things to encourage rice farmers to keep going so that we don't lose that flyway. And there's also a benefit because when you're having water sit on the land in places where there's sandy soil, a lot of that water is going back into the ground and recharging the aquifers. So, again, complex trade-offs.
And something we haven't touched on yet are the animals that swim in our water, fish in California. How are fish faring during this drought?
Well, certainly the reductions in flows in the streams are having impact, both in the delta and further upstream or for the salmon populations. I think, you know, the thing with the fish populations and the drought is these can sometimes be, you know, effects that are seen, you know, several years down the line as the populations change. So there's definitely, you know, the environmental side of it has been quite striking for some of these species.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it's hard to tell what's going on right now because, you know, again, these aren't, fish aren't reporting their quarterly earnings. You know, they don't have a way to check in. But the indicators suggest that that salmon have really gotten hammered you know, the Delta smelt, which is the species that is on the verge of extinction, is really functionally extinct at this point. We're just keeping it alive in these very high-tech tanks. And, you know, we can talk about how farmers have taken a hit and how we in the cities are having to cut back. But really, it's, I think, the fish are probably the hardest hit of all.
What about, I want to get into a little bit, you know, people are acting like this drought. I mean, the drought is unprecedented, of course. But, of course, in California, we've had droughts before. We will have droughts again. What have we learned from past droughts that can help guide us through this one?
Well, one of the things that's happened in past droughts is that droughts are a great way to sort of get over humps in policy in other areas that you aren't able to get over
otherwise.
Because
it creates a crisis that needs action.
Exactly. And but it's a different kind of crisis compared to, say, a wildfire, because it's a very slow-moving disaster. It unfolds over years, not over days. But we have seen, you know, some changes. If you look back to the drought of 77, 76, 77, that was really the beginning of a real push for irrigation efficiency in agriculture. There were a lot of changes that went on in terms of adoption of drip irrigation systems, management of those systems as well. We put a lot of effort into weather stations across the state that help growers understand when they need to water, how much they need to water. So that was sort of a 76, 77. In the late 80s, the drought we had there actually created legislation that at least opened up partially the ability for us to do water markets in the state by changing some of the water law that was needed to be changed in order to do that. And if you look at this drought, to go back earlier in the conversation, you know, we're looking at groundwater management. So we do see some changes that come out of these things, and we want to kind of take hold of those and use them as an opportunity when we can.
The other thing that we can learn from past droughts is, you know, that a drought almost always ends with floods, not because of some hydrological phenomenon, but because you need a big event, like a flooding event, to really end a drought. And so when you're in a drought, that's really the time to be thinking about flooding. And it would be great if we could be thinking about that now and really figuring out how we can take advantage of a big pulse of water coming down rivers to recharge aquifers. And get some of that water back in the ground rather than just having it all flood our cities or go right back out into the ocean.
And that gets back to the point you made earlier about the different interest groups organizing around this issue. People living in flood areas, that's going to be at the top of their concerns, which is very different than farmers' concerns, which is very different than say, Southern California cities' concerns.
Right, right. But it could there could be some overlap there. I mean, if we
well, that's what I was going to get to. Where can we find common ground on some common sense solutions? It sounds like the recent legislation that was passed is something everyone was able to buy into. Are there other things? Are there other low hanging fruit that there can now be an opportunity to bring these groups together to agree on?
Yeah, I think that in terms of groundwater recharge, that's a real area for opportunity. You know, I know there's some work that's been done, you know, just testing out whether it makes sense for a farmer to flood fields if they live in a sandy soiled area. Can they take some of that flood water and just put it on their land and have it drain into the aquifer? And if there was a little bit of support, or if the groundwater laws were there so that they could benefit from that, you know, I put this water into the land, and so I get to take it out at some point. So it makes sense for me to build berms around and take that risk of flooding fields. And probably, I know there's some research that's been happening about this, but there probably needs to be more to show farmers if it makes sense. You know, does this ruin your crops if you do this, or does it make your fields more productive?
Yeah, there's actually several projects that the University of California is working on with growers, testing this out. It's going to vary by crop. There's some very progressive growers in the Central Valley I know right now who when they do have the water available, have flooded, for instance, vineyards, and they seem to be very tolerant in the winter to flooding. We're doing some research on flooding alfalfa fields as well. You have to look at, like, how long can you flood it before you start to impact the yields of the field. There's other factors that come into play. You don't want to flood a field that has recently had a pesticide application or something, because then you're just flushing those chemicals down into your groundwater system. But I do think that, you know, with this groundwater management idea, we need to look at all options of increasing storage in the state and capturing those high flows in any way we can.
We have a question from John who tweeted us and asks, has the nutrient content of California soil changed in certain areas because of the drought?
That's a really interesting question. I have no idea.
Okay, Doug Parker?
Yeah, I'm not sure that nutrient levels would have changed too much. It depends, obviously, on your farming system. If the primary source of your nutrients, I'm thinking mostly like nitrogen, phosphorus, the macronutrients, is fertilizer. Often the drought will, I mean, because you're not getting rainfall and you're irrigating less, you may be increasing concentrations in the soil, but that may be beneficial for the plants as long as you manage the water properly for those plants. So in terms of micronutrients, I'm not an expert that could really know much about that part of it.
Okay, John, thanks for reaching out. We also have a question from Vanessa in Berkeley who asks, how much water does fracking use in comparison to agriculture? Do either of you have knowledge about fracking?
I don't know the exact statistic. I know it's a lot less, but it's still something.
Yeah, what I've seen on fracking, I mean, if you look statewide, it's a pretty minor use of water. I mean, you're getting down to like the Nestle's bottled water kind of case again. But locally, it can be a significant use of water in certain regions. So again, with water, you've got to look at the full system in terms of what's the impact of that. You know, locally, if it's fracking in San Benito County, where you know they're all existing on groundwater supplies already. You know, that may be a significant source of or use of water in that area. But if you look statewide, it's a pretty small number.
What about the way farmers are getting along with each other during this drought? Are they having a united front, or when almond growers are kind of singled out, do others plants that are growers of plants that are less thirsty kind of want to make their case against the almond growers, or are they sticking together? Can you generalize about that? How are farmers reacting to this?
Well, what I've basically seen is, I mean, agriculture. In general, has been sticking together in terms of, you know, we need water. We need water to grow food. We all enjoy eating food. So I think, you know, as an urban citizen, I'm also on their side because I like to eat. That said, you do get, you know, the local kind of water wars of, you know, every farmer needs water. And there are some challenges going on in the courts or elsewhere over, you know, who has the water right, which growers have water rights. I know that the east side and the west side of San Joaquin Valley are having some differences right now over some water. So there's battles in that sense, but often I do see them working together. I actually was down in Half Moon Bay a while back talking to growers down there. And, you know, you maybe have 7 or 8 growers on one of those streams that's coming down to the coastal region. And those growers will actually be talking to each other kind of on a daily basis to ask each other, who's going to irrigate today? Who's going to turn a pump on? Because we know if we all do it at the same time, it dries up the stream. So how do we manage this that we can each have our turn to water and keep some water in the stream for the fish as well? So I've seen a lot of cooperation in some areas, but certainly there is some conflict as well.
What about in your reporting, Nathaniel?
I haven't, you know, I talked to an individual farmer here and there, but I'm not in contact with them as much. I have heard kind of conspiracy theories, you know, people saying that the whole making almonds the whipping boy was thought up by someone in the dairy industry, you know. But, you know, I really don't see any proof of that fact. And, you know, I think that for the most part, farmers would really just like to have city dwellers understand a little bit better about what they're doing, and don't need to add any more myths than already exist.
Well, to that point, we have a question here from Bruce in Marin who emails, do you think there's a cultural misunderstanding between the coast and the valley that leads to misconceptions about agriculture among urban citizens? As urban citizens, are we just epically out of touch with how the world of farming works?
Yes, but it's not our fault. I mean, it's, you know, we live in this disconnected world. We also don't understand how an iPad is put together. You know, we're epically out of touch in that way, too. But with agriculture, it's a little different in that it's this stuff that we eat, you know, and so we have these really primal emotions about making sure that it's good. And so there's this sort of out of touchness coupled to a real deep concern that makes, I think, issues of agriculture and the myths particularly persistent.
And Doug Parker, does your organization try to help dispel those myths around the state?
Well, we do have some Ag in the Classroom type programs where we actually try to bring agriculture to the urban areas and educate people more on that. We actually have some urban farming programs as well, where we're working with people to try to be farming more in urban plots. But there is, I think, a fair disconnect between the urban populations and the rural populations in terms of agriculture. A mistrust, I think, of big ag. You see a lot of that sometimes, certainly, especially, I think, in the Bay Area. We see a lot of that. But really, you get out on some of those farms, you know, and there's good players and bad players in any field. But some of these people are quite progressive in what they're doing and how they're managing not only their water, but their food. And they're very proud of what they're growing and that they're feeding not just Californians, but people across the country and around the world.
We just have a few minutes left. Nathaniel Johnson from grist.org, what are you looking for next in this story?
Well, I'm looking for... I'm interested to see how this groundwater law will play out. I'm watching with sort of horror and fascination as the drought continues. You know, the state is having to make further and further cutbacks, and the farmers are going to court. And so there's going to be some interesting court cases that determine water law for decades going into the future. That's going to be really fascinating. And then there's this issue of how to manage the Delta. Right now, you know, we have the Delta in this kind of political gridlock, and nobody likes the way it is, but all the different competing interests are kind of too scared to give in any direction because they're worried that it'll get worse than it is. So I'm really interested to see if that gridlock can be broken.
And Doug Parker, a final word from you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking for sort of a greater understanding on all sides of sort of the needs of water in California. I don't see it as sort of a, you know, us versus them. I mean, the state constitution says the water belongs to the people of California. And I think that, you know, our goal is to put that to its highest and best use, regardless of what that is. You know, as an urban resident, you know, I actually am happy to go and look at my brown lawn and think that, you know, by having a brown lawn, somebody's growing some extra food that might be out there on the planet for all of us to enjoy.
That's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Doug Parker, director of the California Institute for Water Resources, and Nathaniel Johnson, food writer at grist.org. Thank you both very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to you, our listeners, for joining us as well. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaDelippe. Tonight's show was produced by Sarah Stotter. Next Monday, join my co-host Joseph Pache for City Visions. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.
More on the water crisis later this evening and the rebroadcast of Your Call. Today's topic was, what can we learn from the world's most water-efficient cities? And all week, we'll be looking at solutions on Your Call. Tomorrow, how should we price water, and are we ready to pay more? On Wednesday, could recycled water help fill our needs in a drier future? On Thursday, asked for water-saving advice, Governor Brown said, eat a veggie burger. What difference would that make? And on Friday, who's doing the best reporting on the water crisis in California and worldwide? That's all week on Your Call, every weekday morning at 10 a.m. here on KALW. Well, we have some great music heading your way after As It Happens on the Spoleto Chamber Music Festival. Tonight you'll hear some music of Mendelssohn, his piano trio in D minor, Opus 49, number 1, Bieber's Armonia Artificioso Arioso, and Partita number 3. Two songs of Johannes Brahms as well on Spoleto Chamber Music, followed by The Record Shelf with Jim Schweda. Tonight, Jim will be offering critical reactions to the latest compact disc releases. The Record Shelf at 10. Here on KALW, San Francisco. Good evening. I'm David Latulip. Thanks for being with us. It's 8 o'clock.
Hi, I'm Laura Lynch.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
It's all Greek, even to the Greeks. Just